Hello, everyone. My name is Bruce McConnell, and I am the Global Vice President of the East-West Institute and head up the Institute's Global Cooperation in Cyberspace program. Welcome to another edition of EWI Podcast, where we explore today's pressing global issues with leading thinkers, influencers, and analysts. As always, you can check out all of our podcast episodes on our website, on SoundCloud, and on iTunes, all under the name of East-West Institute. Today, we are talking encryption, an issue that is increasingly controversial. Joining me to discuss some of the many layers behind the encryption debate is an authority on the topic from the public sector perspective, Mr. Cyrus Vance Jr., the incumbent New York County District Attorney, a role he has served since January 2010. This is something of an historic occasion, actually. About 50 years ago, my father and Cy's father worked together in the Department of Defense trying to figure out ways to solve another vexing problem, the Vietnam War. So it is a pleasure to welcome you to the EWI podcast.
Bruce, I'm glad to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Encryption is an important tool for protecting valuable information from access by unauthorized persons. A critical question is, can we find a way to protect legitimate uses while giving law enforcement the ability to get the information it needs to prevent and investigate crime? Cy, you have been an important voice on law enforcement issues in this area. As a law enforcement official, how do you look at encryption?
First of all, I appreciate the powerful, positive reality of strong encryption. And to that degree, we rely upon it here in our communications, in our law enforcement office. And of course, I think people should have the ability to speak and communicate with a high level of confidence that their communications won't be overheard or observed. But I also think that we are at a point when our government and our population needs to understand that there's a price we pay for this privacy. And I liken it to the question of, does the Constitution or does common sense give us the right to anonymity or just privacy? And I believe from a constitutional and legal perspective, the Constitution does not give us a right to anonymity. There has always been, in the 300 years roughly of our nation's history, a recognition that based upon a certain showing and to a neutral and independent judge, that law enforcement should have the power to obtain information which otherwise might be held privately. It used to be that criminal information or the communications about crimes and between criminals were stored on notebooks that were hidden in sock drawers or in bank vaults or in other places like cars. But our laws evolved to recognize that, notwithstanding the fact that it's your personal home, upon a certain showing, law enforcement should have access. And fundamentally, Bruce, I think that same analysis applies to today, and that there is no real distinction under our law between whether we hold information that's relevant to a criminal investigation in an electronic device or in a safe in a house. So this is the challenge we have. How are we going to permit law enforcement to do its job to protect the public at a time when communications among those who are committing crimes, whether it's cybercrime, identity theft, child predation, terrorism, are being stored and are being essentially locked away from any ability of law enforcement to get it?
So I think that's right, and you're on the front lines in some sense in this. What kinds of situations have you run into here in New York?
I think we've really seen the gamut. We have a very sophisticated cyber lab, which we have now has several years up and running. And so we have, once the decision was made by Apple in the fall of 2014, in its upgrade from iOS 7 to iOS 8, to have their devices default encrypted, requiring no action by the purchaser. And if the purchaser decided not to back up to the cloud, as is the purchaser's option, then the information is stored on the device, which Apple, by design, said it could no longer open. So we have tracked those devices. The bigger picture is about 1,700 devices, Apple iDevices, have come into our office, and about 73% of those devices received by our digital forensic unit were locked when we got them. Obviously, the operating systems have changed and evolved over the last 3 to 4 years. But here's where I think we see the impact on cases. Number one, it is inarguable that there is relevant evidence on smartphones that is essential to our proving cases in court. And one example that I give as a demonstration of that is we had a tragic case where a man was murdered while he was at home with some friends playing cards. He happened to have the iPhone in his hand when the intruder comes into the room. The gentleman who has the iPhone actually points it to the intruder simply because that, I guess, was his natural instinct. And he actually records the intruder shooting and killing the man holding the phone. The phone drops to the floor. The assailant threatens anybody in the room with harm if they talk and leaves. That was before 2014. Mm-hmm. If that had happened in 2014 after September, the evidence of that crime may well have been locked away by the passcode only known by the person who was deceased. So there's an example where we were able to get that information and it was critical in terms of proving the homicide. And we see that again and again, whether it's identity theft, economic crimes, or another case is an example where we were at a very serious and terrible incident of child sexual abuse. We were able, through information from the child, able to understand that there may have been more pictures taken, and we were able to get access to that device ultimately, and we're able to prove the full scope of the crime. This is where the real impact is going to be felt by encryption. It's going to be felt by offices like ours doing terrorism investigations, but it's going to be much more important in the day-to-day cases of crime all around our office and other offices. The second area is information on smartphones that may exculpate an individual. And we have done a recent survey at our office, and the results of that survey back from our assistants was that there was, I believe it was 17, I'm not sure of the exact number, but 17 cases where information that the assistants were able to get out of the electronic devices actually demonstrated to them that the person that law enforcement was focusing on or had arrested was not the person who had committed a crime, or that the person had not committed a crime at all. And that those cases range from very serious cases like murder to less serious cases. But no one is, in the very unusual context of our criminal justice system, is really focusing on that, since everything is stored in digital form, information that may prove innocence and is inaccessible is no less important to obtain that information that may prove culpability. So those are two areas, two examples of why it's important. And I think it is really inarguable that at the national security level and in the cases of investigating terrorism, that individuals who are planning or executing those offenses are using digital communications, and they are being directed to have them done on encrypted platforms so that law enforcement cannot obtain them.
So, but in the case that everybody's familiar with, of course, Apple versus FBI, the San Bernardino case, the FBI basically paid somebody to crack the phone and they got the information. So what's the problem?
What you describe is, I think, colloquially referred to as lawful hacking. And indeed, in that case, it is reported that the FBI paid a lot of money and someone else gave them the mechanism to open the phone. And indeed, we are having to do just that because without movement by Apple and Google, we are ourselves both lucky enough to have funds to have that outside expertise, but it is a very unsatisfactory solution for several reasons. First and foremost, it's reported that the FBI spent $1 million to open that phone. Let's say it was $500,000. $500,000 can be the entire law enforcement budget of a county, of some of our counties in the United States. And those counties, like cities, have victims of seniors who are being victimized by internet fraud, by kids who are being victimized by sexual predators who film the acts of sex abuse, and on and on. And so it really, to me, is not an answer, lawful hacking, because small counties simply can't afford it. And the FBI can't deliver that solution and share it with the counties because it doesn't want to expose its operational tactics and availabilities. So for both those reasons, I think it's not an answer, although it is easy to say, if you're the county that doesn't have the money, then it's not possible to do.
No, that's right. I think it's a matter of scalability, and you also don't necessarily want every county to have that capability. Because as we've been talking, it's a balance here, and it's a kind of thing that could be misused. So you want it in a few places when it's necessary, it seems to me.
Well, I think why should New York have ability to access a certain percentage of devices, but upstate New York not have that? I'm not sure who evens that out, but federal legislation that applies all over America and to all states certainly would do that. The second point, Bruce, I don't think I mentioned was, by the time we get access to these devices using external advisors, it could be 18 months or 2 years after the device was seized. And Apple, obviously, when it realizes that there has been an operability access point, it will patch that point and make the temporary solution no longer a solution. And this time gap is not something that people, I think, can just dismiss lightly. Victims are seeking justice in cases where they have been the victim of sometimes physical assault or economic crime, and so they need to have their cases adjudicated and have their rights respected. And secondly, cases that come into our criminal court system should move on a tight and quick timescale. We have speedy trial limits. And so getting access to a device 18 months or 2 years after it's seized may be cold comfort if that case has already been resolved one way or the other.
In February, the East-West Institute launched a report, Encryption Policy in Democratic Regimes, Finding Convergent Paths and Balanced Solutions, at the Munich Security Conference. We got a generally positive reception from governments, technology providers, and privacy advocates, but the issue is far from resolved. Tsai and his institutions, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, participated in the report's development, along with cybersecurity experts, human rights and privacy advocates, and other law enforcement agencies from the U.S., Europe, and India. The report lays out two approaches to giving law enforcement access to the plain text of encrypted information, limited to cases of serious crimes and where a judge has issued a warrant. We call one way lawful hacking. We were discussing this. It's like what the FBI did in the Apple case. It hacked the phone. This approach requires providing law enforcement with the technical skills and financial resources necessary to defeat stronger and stronger encryption. The other approach we call design mandates. Here, the government would require technology product and service providers to have the capability, upon receipt of a court order granted under specific circumstances, to give investigators the plain text of information that had been encrypted by their product or service. The capability would be designed into the product. Both approaches have their pros and cons, and they're not mutually exclusive, but it seems to me your view is that we need to go at least partially down the road of design mandates.
I'd say two things. First of all, I think we need leadership at the federal level in Washington, D.C., in coordination with state actors, because we are so affected by cybercrime. I think we need to actually have conversations with the technology community that are facilitated by our executive leadership in Washington, D.C. I have spoken with many technologists, and my views, they disagree with strongly. But when you sit down and talk, they're family people just like I'm a family person. And they don't want a criminal to be able to victimize their family and get away with it because the access to information relevant to proving that crime is hidden away. And neither do I. It's how do we get that information that is where the rub is. And I do believe there is much more ground to be covered that has not yet been explored, where law enforcement and technology can sit together, guided by a strong executive push, to come to some forward movement and technical solutions to what Apple and Google now say is impossible. I absolutely reject the concept that it is impossible to solve this problem with a balance. When we look at all the technology that we have designed and that these two amazing companies have designed to do all the things they do, surely there is a path forward through design that may get both sides toward where they both want to be. Now, I'm not sure that the government should be dictating design, however. I think we should be dictating accessibility, and design should follow that mandate. In CALEA, for example, we didn't dictate what telephone companies had to do, they just had to provide access. And they objected to it initially, but ultimately they provided access to it. They objected to it for the same kinds of reasons we're hearing today. But now, when that went into effect in 1994, the world survived, and government was able to gain access to information of drug dealers and organized criminals, and that's a good thing, and we survived that. So I think that we should get together, guided by our national elected leaders, to solve this problem, and I would stay away from mandating design as opposed to mandating a certain access through a certain process.
Right, exactly. The goal would be that the technology is designed by the manufacturers or the service providers to allow them to get the text. They don't need to give you the keys, they just need to give you the text.
And by the way, I think it's important for folks to remember that up until September of 2014, when Apple went into the default device encryption redesign, Apple and Google had been providing just what you're talking about in response to court-ordered search warrants for a long time without objection and without any claim by the company that there was a lack of security in accessing device off smartphones that had been sent to them by our office accompanied by a search warrant from a judge. All of a sudden, after the Snowden aftermath, Apple has taken the different position that it is impossible to safely pursue the path of access to the electronically stored information that they had been pursuing for years before. So I question whether the issue was one of security or public relations in the aftermath of Snowden. But in any event, we are where we are, and I think we need to sort this out, because if we don't, ultimately there's going to be either a series of cases or a case that is going to so enrage the American public because information was not accessible, that I think it's going to actually boomerang and cause legislation which is going to be far more strict and far less forgiving to these companies than it is today.
So exactly, that's the principal reason behind our report, is to start to have these kinds of conversations that we need to have beforehand.
And thank you for your leadership.
We may not have the political will to do anything about it yet, but at some point we will, and at that point we want good law, not bad law. On the Snowden case, I think that it did shift the balance, the view of the public and certainly of the tech community about privacy and security is shifted, along with the concerns about increasing level of cyber attack. So I think more security is necessary, and so we're operating in a different security environment than we were in the past. You mentioned CALEA, the Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act, which has an interesting feature, which is that law enforcement has to reimburse the costs to the companies of installing the accessibility to wiretaps and also to responding. So, and that's one of the things we advocate in our report, that can also be used as a metering mechanism so that there wouldn't be necessarily excessive calls for decryption on minor cases if there was a kind of a budgetary thought. Right. What do you think about that?
Well, I would not dismiss that out of hand. Mm-hmm. The concept is not new in many areas of criminal and civil discovery in cases in court, that there is a reimbursement for costs. I would say this, though, that the situations in which it is relevant to us are different than private litigants. These are public agencies, small police departments, bigger police departments, DA's offices, who have to get this information to do the job that they were elected or appointed to do. And we should look for some, if it does come down to an issue of cost, and I'm not sure it does, I think Apple has several hundred billion dollars that it could fund in a victim's fund to pay for accessing devices without dropping a penny in their stock value. We should be open about that, and we should not dismiss it out of hand, because we are asking them to do something that costs something, and that should be put into the mix.
That's right. And so who pays is a good question. But I think in the Apple case, they would also run into a concern about liability if they did this on their own. And I think that's why we need legislation in this area. We are going to need to have some laws made that will enable this and require it, but also protect the companies from things. And so that it's hard to get legislation passed these days. How do we get there?
Well, amen to what you just said. I've been working on this for 4 years, and there has been one bill that was put out by two very smart senators and was out for, I think, a couple of days before it was then taken back. This is obviously an area where we are having a difficult time even getting legislation produced, and partly because I think it's technical, mm-hmm. and because it's technical, everyone thinks that, well, it's just too complicated for us to even know how we should approach this. Of course, that's ridiculous. This is a very sophisticated country. These are very sophisticated companies. And we just need to get off our respective bases and start walking toward each other. In any event, the way to go forward, I believe, is if I were running the world, I would put tech and law enforcement together. I might, like a labor negotiation, drag each one of them by the collar into a room, lock it, and say, you've got 90 days to come out with a concept by which we can move forward on this process. Clearly, we need to find ways that tech can deal with law enforcement and the public to talk about how we can move this forward. Right now, at least my observation is, technology has folded its arms, crossed its chest, and said, no way.
As one of my tech friends said, I guess you just disagree with math. So math has its place. It's not all things can be described by mathematics. But I would add to your locked room, I would add representatives of a couple of other people, victims, for example, and the privacy and human rights community, because the concern, obviously exacerbated by Snowden, but especially on an international basis, is that privacy and encryption can be used for good as well as evil. And so that kind of balancing is important, and I certainly find that if there's more than two parties in the room, you can make more interesting deals.
Well, I can't disagree with your inclusion of either of those categories, because they are both affected in important ways by encryption or lack of encryption, and they are smart and are consumers.
Well, and they'll be vocal in the conversation, because the tech and privacy issues align somewhat in this area, but not 100%.
But we talk about the way forward, and I think we've talked about one model, the labor model, but it's not as if we don't have this already operating successfully in other areas. The banking system, for example, is very focused on privacy and very focused on encryption its communications. It manages to be able to respond to court-ordered subpoenas, and we're talking about a judge.
Yep.
Making the call.
Absolutely.
About whether there's sufficient evidence to ask for it. Banking has found a way to balance privacy versus responding to law enforcement subpoenas.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we see that in medical, in the hospitals as well. So it's being done. To suggest that smartphones are somehow so different than other technological applications strikes me as being too facile, too easy an explanation to really be credible.
Well, I think you point out as well that you have to look at the different places that information is and treat them differently. So it's on a smartphone, that's one situation. If it's in a cloud service where somebody like Google is encrypting it with their own keys and they do it as a service, especially for businesses, they have the ability to get that back because the customer is going to lose their password and they expect Google to be able to retrieve it for them. So cloud service providers are a different bag. Banks, as you say, and enterprises, obviously for business reasons, need to get the information. And then there's information in transit, like on encrypted messaging, like WhatsApp and whatnot, which also have a different ways of getting the problem solved. So you have to disaggregate it.
Well, we actually proposed a solution to Congress, to Senators Burr and Feinstein early on, and we suggested that we start by focusing on data at rest. The smartphone, what's on the smartphone? Because I think people understand that concept. It's like a search warrant on a house or a search warrant on a car. It's a physical object which contains information, and we should be able to access that device. In transit communications, I think presents a more complicated problem, not an insurmountable problem, but if we just started to understand that criminals are in fact using these devices to commit all sorts of crimes, to facilitate them, and to store the information, that's happening. It's ineluctable. You can't deny it. It's happening in important cases. And right now, it's the arms race that the tech companies want, is to try to outfox them or outsmart them or outspend them to break their technology. It's not a way, I think, that the government and the country should be run, when the government and the country has not only an obligation to help those companies prosper, as they have done so amazingly, prospered, that there's also a concurrent obligation often to the customers of those same companies, like myself, who hold these devices, who are victims of crime, that ought to be in the balance. And we should not essentially outsource criminal justice evidence gathering to tech companies who are private companies with shareholders and board of directors who are fundamentally motivated by increasing sales and getting higher stock value.
One of the ways this debate is skewed is that we talk about the design mandates as having possible impact on cybersecurity, but the absence of them has possible impacts on physical security, and physical security is a human right as much as privacy, and I think sometimes people forget that.
And I would also say, recognizing that the problem is international, and so I have to acknowledge that there are many different views on this issue. Europeans have their own legislative privacy imperative, but when we let business sell merchandise in the country, it is not a novel concept that there ought to be public safety requirements for the merchandise that is sold, particularly when it's mass merchandise. Volvo can't import cars into America unless it meets certain minimum standards that are focused on consumer safety. And the world has managed to survive with America having standard safety guidelines for certain products. In one sense, I think it may be that we need to look at the contents of devices not just as a privacy issue, but as a safety issue and an obligation that in the wrong hands, just like a car can cause great harm and mischief, a locked phone which is inaccessible by anyone except the criminal also can cause harm.
I think that's right. As the industry matures, it will have to come under some more regularized
procedures. I think the industry has matured.
We have
the largest corporations in the world.
Yes.
So this started out as something
sort of
scrappy and let them grow. Right now, they are essentially playing a big part in running the world.
Indeed, indeed. As I say, we talk to all the major cyberpowers, China, Russia, the United States, Google, Microsoft. Before we close, I'd like to again thank New York District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. for sharing his insights on encryption today. Look for us on our website, on SoundCloud and iTunes under the name of East West Institute, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Bruce.